We are one with nature. We're a part of it. It's a part of us. And that, for me, drove a lot of my poetry and drove a lot of my stories, drove a lot of my work, drove my activism for sure. And I would say that that's the most important, that we still could learn from that today.
Do you think that your early experience with taking mescaline or LSD, did that sharpen or deepen that awareness of connection?
I can remember one of the early trips with my friends, sitting in one of the living rooms. There was just a half a dozen or so of us, and the rush coming on and saying, "Orange is the color of love. Orange is the color of love." And I had a fan or I had a book or something. I had to cover my face, I remember. And I sat there in some kind of reverie for a while during this love experience that was endless. I love my friends, I love my family, I love the earth, I love, but it was just love is that essence that is behind every, if you talk about a dark sun or a bright sun, maybe that's what that is, but it infuses everything, whether we acknowledge it or not. And so I think that it was more the experience of love. The magical, I don't know what it is, I don't know why it is, but my mother, when she moved from Philadelphia to work, she went to the Pocono Mountains. So I would go up to the Poconos. I stayed with my Grammy and Pop and my sister and went to school. And they were such good providers. Really, it was a blessing for my sister and I, even though I missed the warmth of my mother and the sparkle. And certainly my father was extremely close with my father, and that was very difficult. But I'd go up every summer, and Stroudsburg and East Stroudsburg and Cresco and Mountain Home, all those areas in the Pocono Mountains. I mean, it is nature. That's what people love up, I mean, did then anyway. And I mean, there were the clubs too, so that was fun, you know, but theater, summer stock and that kind of thing, a great group of kids. But I can remember going out and walking by myself in the streams there, and just feeling totally like I was in church without having those words. I mean, I'd say those words in reflection now, but that's the feeling that I have, you know. And I have a poem about that, and because I can remember these boys came along while I was walking in the stream, and they said, you know, there's black snakes in that water. And I can remember just looking at them and going, thanks for letting me know. And I just turned away from them, and I did. I guess I had that, you know, I just wasn't going to be told to be afraid or you know, wasn't going to let it interfere with my experience, you know. I just, you know, took myself out and did what I want, you know. And I had a lot of freedom because my mother worked. So I also was very domestic. I made a cake every week. I cooked every night dinner for her. This is in my teenage years when I'd go up there. So I think that reverence or that deepening, I don't know, nature just always, I wanted to go to the parks in Philadelphia all the time. I loved the parks. We used to pick up garnets there.
Can you describe one of the best summer solstice parties that you remember at Greenfield? Is there a summer solstice or a festival or an occasion of celebration that really sticks out for you?
Summer solstices were always, you know, terrific, and yet fraught with all the political and all the social whatever that goes on in a place of a community like that that's so close. And I can't say that, I mean, really, I don't think I could pick one out. I'm trying to think. I think Kiri's Wedding was great. Kiri's Wedding, Kirsten got married, and Lasara also got married on Greenfield Ranch. So those, I think those weddings were really wonderful, you know, so back to nature. And, you know, by then our pagan lifestyle had emerged. And of course, that lifestyle is very closely associated with a deep love of nature because, you know, most people by this time know, but not everyone knows that really pagan means country dweller, like heathen means someone who lived on the heaths, the wise women, the wise people, the healers. So I could relate. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I thought that they were just, you know, those people who got fed to the lions. But so it was hard for me to take on that description of my spiritual life. But I feel comfortable with it now. Even though I said it to someone the other day and I saw his eyes go into little, you know, like, what? But he was someone not familiar, you know, he's still maybe a little attached to his Catholic faith, but not totally. He was interested, so, in what that was, because he looks around my house here and there are images of all, you know, of every religion probably that I could, I mean, Hindu, Catholic, pagan, you know, Syrian, all of it, you know, Christian for sure. And, you know, the skull there with the lights on it, I love that. You know, my deer antlered skull that I have a little lights on. And so, yeah, he could see that there was a lot, you know, of a melding of spiritual pathway. And I, as I mentioned before, I have never really been able to practice one guru or one teacher or anything like that. And yet I love the wisdom that these teachers provide. And I love the different pathways. And I say about the gods, the more the merrier. So I started practicing pagan, and so those weddings were more pagan. We honored the directions, and you know, they were all fancied up, and it was beautiful, those things. And all the solstices were great, the watermelon races. And I got stung by a yellow jacket on my tongue at home on a summer solstice. So if I think of summer solstices that I remember, that was probably the else, because my tongue, I was allergic and I had to put my teeth on my tongue because it was swelling. I was afraid it was going to close my throat, and they rushed me down. At that time, the doctor, Sid Maurer, was at the winery at the bottom of the hill, and I just walked in there with my tongue clamped on my tongue, and they just said, okay, come with me, and gave me a shot of epinephrine or something, which immediately stop the swelling. And then I went, once I was knew I was okay, then I went to the ranch house. And I think it was Lynn who had maybe ice cream. And someone gave me some ice cream, and I can remember licking that ice cream. And that cold ice cream took the rest of the swelling down. Those yellow jackets, they're so mean, so awful. And when we first went up there, because we're going into their territory, there were a lot of yellow jacket nests. And so I had to be very careful, for sure. But there's not as many now. There's still some, but, you know, not where the places developed. They're a little more, they've gone other places. We had bees and stuff too, but the bees weren't nasty like yellow jackets are.
Do you remember other songs that you would sing, or songs that you would sing in those early days with your kids, or just by yourself?
Oh, I love songs. I have tons of songs now. Early day songs. Well, there were all the lullabies that my mother sang to me, and I sang to my own children, and have sung to my grandchildren, like Tora Laura Laura and Wind of the Western Sea, like low, low, breathe and blow, wind of the western sea, over the rolling waters blow, come from the dying winds and go, blow, blow him again to me, while my little one, while my pretty one sleeps. Flow Gently, Sweet Afton, that was another favorite. All the Pretty Little Horses, all those lullabies. That my kids couldn't even go to sleep if I didn't sing to them. I loved it. Oh, maybe this is one that people would like to hear, because I have taken a lot of the hymns of my childhood and converted them a little. For the beauty of the earth, for the glory of the sky, for the love which from our birth over and around us lies, Mother Earth and Father Sun, thank you, we on earth are one. This is my verse, the next one. Fur and feather, scale and skin, live on earth as sacred kin. Scented flower, fruited vine, Lord and Lady, all divine. Mother Earth and Father Sun, thank you, we on earth are one. And so it is. My kids, I'm pretty proud of them and their accomplishments and what the kind of people they are, trying to change the world and do good things and, you know, create a social atmosphere that in which positive change can occur. I have a 501c3 called the Magical Cauldron of the Western Sea, and our mission is personal growth on the ecstatic edge.
As you look back over those early years of being at Greenfield and the pioneering experience for you, how do you think that shaped you? The fact that you chose to do that, how did that make you who you are?
Well, the kind of smart-ass answer is poor. Broke. I mean, it's not just the aspect of not being able to make money or something, you know, or have enough to support us, which was so, and it was a constant factor in our lives. But what came out of that in a personal way is that I began to understand and trust that survival was not dependent on the amount of money I had in the bank or in my pocket or anything else. That as a matter of fact, the days were going to pass and we were going to have good times with the children, and we're going to teach and we're going to learn and we're going to do all these things. And yes, I made a little money because I taught in the rec departments and such like that. And I sometimes taught at Mariposa, and then I got my kids schooling. I mean, so I got something for that, but not in hand. But I did learn to be, well, I guess I was always resourceful, but I began to trust that resourcefulness and trust that not everything comes in the form of gold or money or, you know, that kind of energy. Would I often wish I had a little more dough? Yeah. Yeah. Right now. I wish so. I'd like to get my computer fixed and a new pair of shoes. But it's not what runs my life. That is not the thing that makes life good or bad for me. And I wish that more people would resonate with the idea that, you know, the money, the paycheck is not to be all and end all, that there are the things you do in your life that you create, that you offer. And of course, as a child, I was brought up a Methodist and Presbyterian, and I served in those capacities. And those spiritual pathways, I'll call them, for, rather than religious entities, really were focused in service. And I grew up with the notion of service. My father was a great humanitarian during his life. And so I got that. I feel like I got that from him, and, you know, that it lives in me. And my mother just was a sparkling beauty of, you know, just sweet and loving. And not always, mind you, she still had that Scots-Irish. However, her essence was she sparkle, singing. She loved to be happy. And so that's not a bad combination, is it?
And how do you think the fact of the influx of so many people like you who came here in the early 70s and throughout that decade, how has that shaped, or has it shaped, Mendocino County itself as a place?
Mendocino County changed significantly by the influx of so many hippies, so many back to the landers. I mean, I can remember some disgruntlements in the political seat, which is Ukiah, for in those early days. I can remember when, what was the store, the corner store, is that the name of it? And sometimes we'd meet up with, you know, some of the more old-time community members. And sometimes they'd grumble a little, because they saw businesses being taken over. They saw businesses growing. They also heard as time went on that we weren't in support of the logging industry as a whole. Not that we didn't use it to build our houses, but we were judicious, let us say. And we certainly weren't supporting clear-cutting redwoods and that kind of thing. And so we started to enact that. So yes. And then, I mean, then there was the Environmental Center, which I was very active in supporting in the early days and all the way through, and Redwood Summer. So these things affected this county a lot. They affected this county tremendously to the point of who we are today. I mean, I think we are known for supporting the earth, like tending toward wanting the earth to survive and going out of our way to say, no, that's not okay, when it's something like the hack and squirt or clear cutting and those kinds of things. And I know I have done more than my share of activism. I mean, from going across the country, which was with four youngest children on the Great Peace March for Global Nuclear Disarmament in 1986, and then Walk Your State in 88, and the Florida Peace Pilgrimage, and all of those. And then that changed to the environmental work once we got back from that. We thought we had done a great job, by the way, because there's so many people that supported the end of the nuclear industry, especially for militarization. And all the way across, I mean, the country, we met people who supported us even, and we supported them. I mean, it wasn't all about the nuclear thing. Like, we supported the people who were losing their farms in Nebraska. And we did all kinds of work on the way. That lent it. And I honestly thought, I went 7 years to the test site with my four youngest children until I realized it was no longer safe to go there because they were starting to do weird things and irradiating and running over people. And I mean, it's got to be a mess. It wasn't safe for me and the kids to be there. So 7 years in a row, though, we protested there. So, but when I came back, we thought, well, okay, we got something done. They're not going to do overground testing anymore and this and that. Boy, are we surprised today. I cannot believe they're still building more nuclear sites. Shut it down, people. Shut it down.
Often there are references to the Back to the Land experience that I read about or hear about, and there's a seems to be kind of like a general dismissal of it, kind of like, oh, that didn't work, or that failed, and you know, what went wrong?
If someone were saying to me, the Back to the Land movement failed, I would have to ask, in what way did it fail? Why do you think it failed? Because I can only make up what they would think, because it didn't fail for me, you know. My children and my grandchildren all love the land. Now, what perhaps failed is the social experiment, the part that people just can't seem to get along. That seems to be a more serious issue than ever these days. I myself, I am totally stunned at the amount of judgment, criticism, separation that is within our own ranks. It blows my mind. And somehow that makes me feel like maybe I have failed. And yet I don't think so. You know I have done everything in my power to create a better world, to teach the children well, you know, and to love unconditionally, to forgive unconditionally. I know that's hard. People go, forgive unconditionally. I am not going to forgive. No, you can forgive unconditionally, because otherwise it's a burden on your own heart and soul and spirit. You walk around angry. That makes a difference in your body and the way you think and the way you act and how you interrelate. So you practice unconditional forgiveness. Yes, I forgive you. And then you come in with a beginner's mind, with a fresh outlook. Okay, are we going to? But you don't forget. You still have all the warnings of what went wrong. But there are processes in place that we have learned over these years, that people could come into a room and talk around a table and go by the guidelines and be kind. I know this, that the experience we had in going back to the land, of doing the Back to the Land trip, which it was, I mean, from the roots up, from the naked earth to the whatever we built, whatever we did, to the, you know, coming together and the separations, I know that it was a good thing, but it can't be done again, it seems. And I'm sorry about that. I know there's a lot of young people who strive for it. And I don't want to say absolutely it can't happen. It just seems like there isn't a milieu. There isn't a pot for it to fit into these days. And I know lots of young people want it. And I feel sad about the world that they've inherited at this point. And I hope it can come around. And, you know, I'd like to really say I see a gold lining out there, you know, silver lining. Look for the silver lining. When air cloud appears in the blue, remember somewhere the sun is shining. And so the right thing to do is make it shine for you. A heart full of joy and gladness will always banish sadness and strife. So always look for the silver lining and find the sunny side. The sunny side of life. I don't know how I remembered that one, but there it is. I guess that's the final word. Cooking on the wood stove. It already sounds like a poem I should write. I loved cooking on the wood stove, and I cooked on the wood stove for 30 years, and I think that that's longer than anyone that I've talked to in this day and age, you know, and not in the old days, but in the, you know, the new days or newish days, I guess they're not new anymore, but, and I had 6 children and oftentimes many more children there. And then there was the summer camp and we had lots of kids at that. And so there was a lot of cooking to be done. And one of the things, of course, as I told you, we went and did the bulk buying. And so we had, that was one of the early things that we realized we had to get bulk, and then we had to have storage for the bulk. So that a lot of efforts, no matter what we thought ideally, like making a fallout shelter, that went by the wayside because the immediacy of living in this way began to demand certain things. But, and then you needed the wood. Don't forget, you had to chop the wood and get the wood to keep the wood stove going. And if it was wet, it was a real drag. So you had to find or do dry wood. And luckily, once we had wooden nickel, we had some tinder and kindling and stuff that we could do. And I did everything on that cook stove. I made the most unique breads that I have ever eaten out of the strangest products long before the advent of what breads are today. I mean, I made bean bread and so many different, whatever I had was going into bread. I made tofu, I made yogurt, and all of that, everything. And what I love about the wood stove is you can, and I made soups every day. All the leftover like trimmings and all go into a boiling pot that was on the stove all the time. So of course the stove was going all the time, especially in the winter, because it also helped heat the house. And so I'd keep that going. And then out of that stock, you'd be making other things. But the one thing about the wood stove that is fabulous, just think about this, folks. If you put the wood in and you get stirring your saute or your soup or whatever you're doing, and then you get called away. Oh, by the way, it's not for a phone call. We didn't have any phones at all. And there were no cell phones either. So I couldn't even have a computer. So there you go. Typewriters. I use typewriters. Anyway, but you're called away for a child or for an animal or something that needs to be done or something. And your food doesn't burn. The fire goes out. I think there's something profound about that, that the fire goes out. Or goes low. It does just what it's supposed to do. So your food isn't ruined. It was just a great thing. So I had mainly soups and stocks going all the time. I cooked all my own bread. I did every original thing that I could. Of course, we had some of those good books to look at and, you know, that would inspire us. But I invented a lot on my own. So we all did. Everyone did. It's the nature of the game. Or the game of nature, perhaps. And it was a blessing. I really feel, I'd cook on a wood, well, no, I couldn't, all that wood and stuff.
We've been listening to a lightly edited interview with Marilyn Mother Bear Scott as part of Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. This program airs on KZYX at 3:30 on Thursday afternoons. You can also catch shorter excerpts during the news hour on Thursday mornings at 7:45 and 8:45, and again at 6 p.m. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.